to most of the patients they studied. So we know that inflammation is involved. We know that when cytokines cross the blood-brain barrier, they can cause problems. So all those can contribute to the neuropsychiatric issues.
Definitely. Now, I did read your research that you were doing in collaboration with Dr. Benros from Copenhagen, and I was really shocked to see the findings. Can you tell our listeners a bit about that research?
So Michael Benros is one of the world's best mental health epidemiologists. And I met him when I was at a conference on PANS and PANDAS. Okay. And that refers to patients or children, primarily in adolescents, who develop neuropsychiatric disorders after a strep infection. So that's pediatric autoimmune neuropsychiatric disorders after strep, PANDAS. And he was giving a report about his findings from a study done in the entire population of Denmark to see what was the frequency of psychiatric disorders after strep infection. And I was thrilled to hear that talk, primarily because I thought, wow, I should try to get this guy to do the same study looking at what happens after Lyme disease. So I cornered him during the coffee hour, and I said to him, if I can get a grant for you to do this study, would you do it with me? And he said, yes. So we worked together over the next month, designed a study, and because he's an expert in this, he really designed the study, and I just gave him some guidance on Lyme disease. And so he ended up looking at the entire population of Denmark, which is about 8 million people, over the course of 22 years, because in the Danish registry, the medical registry, they have medical information on everybody in the population over a 22-year period. So he was able to probe that database to see what happens when someone goes into the hospital or they see an outpatient doctor in the hospital setting or they go to the ER and they get diagnosed with Lyme disease. How many of those patients go on to develop depression afterwards or have suicidal behaviors or actually commit suicide? And because he has the data over a 22-year period, he can follow people up over a very long period of time. And because he's using the entire population of Denmark, there's no bias. He's not excluding people. He's including everybody. And one of the problems with the old studies, the former studies, which including the ones that I've done, is that they're all biased. You know, this percentage of people have anxiety or depression, but they're coming to a research center or they're coming to a psychiatrist's office. So, mm-hmm. You know, I thought, have I really proven that psychiatric problems are a part of this disorder or this infection? And I thought I really hadn't, but the closest I could get would be this epidemiologic study. So he did the study and he compared the Lyme patients to everyone else, those who hadn't been diagnosed with Lyme disease in the hospital setting. And what we found was that the rate of mental disorders was in fact increased in the patients with hospitalization for Lyme disease or a hospital diagnosis of Lyme disease. And sadly, suicide was increased 75% in that group, and suicidal behaviors was increased twofold or 200%. So that was obviously very troubling and disturbing, but it was important because it highlighted that mental disorders and suicide is indeed a risk among patients who have had a serious case. Now, I say a serious case because this registry only records people who were diagnosed in the setting either of an outpatient hospital clinic or ER setting or inpatient. So people who might have seen their primary care doctor and because of a rash and never gone to the hospital weren't included in this. They would have actually.
Wow. Shocking results, but aren't I think they? It really speaks to the importance of diagnosing and treating people.
It does. It does. And, you know, I hear these terrible stories of people, and I've seen patients, of course, who are so profoundly depressed and they need a lot of support. And one thing the patients need to know is that they can get better. And I've been working in this area for such a long time. I've seen some extremely sick patients get tremendously better and be able to live happy and full lives. It doesn't mean that they're 100% without any symptoms, but most of them are like 90%. So that's very encouraging.
Absolutely. Now, what kind of approaches should physicians take when their patients with Lyme are showing neuropsychiatric symptoms?
Well, the physicians should do a very careful screen to see, does the person have depression? And then if they do have depression, is there indication of any suicidal thoughts or wish to be dead? Or have they made any, have they had any thoughts about how they might kill themselves or actually made any plans to do that or any behaviors to do that? So there's two very easy instruments that they can avail themselves of that are free and online. One is the PHQ-9, which is a measure of depression. And at the end of it, you get a score, and it tells you whether the person is moderately depressed or severely depressed or only mildly depressed. And anybody who's moderately depressed or more, you know, you want to make sure that they get into some kind of treatment and be evaluated by a mental health professional. That's number one. And then the other instrument that's really helpful is the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale. And I'm not saying that because I come from Columbia. I'm saying that because it's used throughout the world and by lots of primary care professionals in the United States in particular. And it's very simple. It's just like six questions. And you can download it onto your phone. And I carry it around on my phone. And it just tells you what questions do you ask the person. And if the person scores in the high risk range, you want to make sure that they get to see a provider immediately. So it's really extremely helpful.
Great. Well, we'll be sure to include those links in our show notes as well. Now, if physicians wanted to learn more about diagnosis and treating Lyme disease, is there specific training that focuses on the neuropsychiatric manifestations of Lyme?
Unfortunately, there really isn't at this point. We're in the process of trying to assess which are optimal treatments for these patients. But at this point, it's really based on each psychiatrist's experience. Sometimes patients come to me and or call me up and say, or a family member calls me up and says, my son is very ill and he's has Lyme disease and he's extremely depressed. And I want him to see a Lyme literate psychiatrist. And my response to them is, in my mind, I'm thinking, well, you're not going to be able to find a Lyme-literate psychiatrist because there aren't that many. That's number one. But number two, if a person has significant depression or anxiety or psychotic symptoms, you want to make sure that they see a good psychiatrist. They don't have to be knowledgeable about Lyme disease. They have to be a good psychiatrist who can treat appropriately with the right psychiatric medications, because often the psychiatric medications can be extremely helpful, even if a person does have underlying infection. Now, if the person doesn't get better and they're seeing a psychiatrist and the psychiatrist has done a really good job and given the best treatments she knows about, then that psychiatrist will think, well, maybe there's something medical going on. And oftentimes it's the mental health professional who says, this isn't right. There's something different about this syndrome. This person has light sensitivity and sound sensitivity. And I don't see that in most of my patients. This person has cognitive problems and this person is only 30 years old or 20 years old. This shouldn't be happening. And so then they bring in the neuropsychologist or then they bring in the medical people to try to help figure this out. So it's really important to take advantage of the mental health professionals out there, and they don't have to be Lyme literate. Obviously, it's nice if they are, because they know the whole political worlds that people with Lyme disease live in, and that can be helpful. Because another thing that happens with Lyme disease, as I'm sure anybody who's had chronic symptoms knows, there's an experience of invalidation. And when you are invalidated, it's traumatic, because especially when you're invalidated by a doctor who you know and love. So your primary care doctor is taking care of you all these years. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden it says, look, I don't know what to do for you. And that's actually not bad. That's not a bad response. I don't know what to do for you. But when they say, I can't help you, you have to go somewhere else, that's not very helpful at all.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I remember it took me about 30 specialists to get till somebody finally said, you know, Sarah, sometimes we just don't know. And I thought, why didn't everybody else say that?
Exactly. Exactly. Doctors, and I say this to the medical, I give examples, you know, to the medical students, and I advise them, you know, the best thing you can do is say you don't know if you don't know.
Mm-hmm. And pretend. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that answer. I mean, people would rather hear that, I think.
Yeah. You know, the COVID pandemic has alerted the entire world to the problem of infectious disease and the problem of the sequelae after a serious infection. So long COVID is something that's all over the media right now. And ME/CFS, that's the chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, myalgic encephalitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, has also gotten a boost in recognition, because it's recognized that many patients with long COVID would also meet criteria for ME/CFS. So that actually has been really helpful to patients with post-infectious or peri-infectious problems, because let's say, like with long COVID, we don't know if people have persistent virus or not, but we do know what their symptom profile is. And let's see if we can help patients using a variety of different treatment approaches that might address their symptoms. So that's happening right now with long COVID. It's happening.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable, the similar mechanisms and symptoms and, you know, the way that it's impairing people's limbic system who are stuck in fight or flight like that.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And that's a horrific feeling, that fight or flight feeling.
Sure is. Yeah. Now, can you share some success stories with us about patients who have recovered with appropriate treatment?
Sure. So one patient I recall came to see me when she was with her mom. She was 14 years old, and she had been in a psychiatric facility because of recurrent psychotic symptoms. And she was, let's say, for an example would be, she was walking along the beach and she saw dolphins jumping out of the ocean, and there are no dolphins in that particular area. So, and she would become paranoid and she would have hallucinations. So she came to see me, and she and her mother were very close, and her mother clearly cared a lot about her. And so I ordered standard Lyme tests and some at that time newer Lyme tests, like the Lyme C6 peptide ELISA. I ordered a brain SPECT scan, because in those days I was impressed by what we could learn from brain SPECT imaging. And we ordered neuropsychological testing as well, or I ordered that. And she did come back positive on the Lyme C6 peptide ELISA. And she did have abnormal neuropsychological findings, typical of what we see with our Lyme patients. And the SPECT imaging did show patchy areas of decreased blood flow. So I called a pediatric neurologist I knew and said, would you be willing to evaluate her and perhaps treat her with intravenous ceftriaxone if you think that's appropriate? He said he would. And the spinal tap came back negative, but he was willing to try treatment anyway, because he realized that this was an unusual presentation, and she did have that positive C6 test, and she got dramatically better. And she was able, over the course of 6 months, to come off of the heavy duty psychiatric medications she was on. And she was able to go on and get awards and statewide awards in her academics where she lived, and went on to graduate school, and she's doing very well. So that was, you know, very.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, that was very gratifying.
Absolutely. Now, I want to just shift gears a little bit towards research. And I just want to start with, is it true that the neuropsychiatric manifestations of Lyme were excluded from the CDC surveillance case definition and were therefore often overlooked in terms of research?
Yes, for sure. And that's definitely true. So the case definition for Lyme disease was set in the early 90s, and that was before any of the neuropsychiatric manifestations were widely recognized. And even if they had been known, then I suspect they would not have been included, because the epidemiologic surveillance criteria were focusing on things that they could measure or see. So if the joint is swollen, that's something they can see. If the rash is expanding in size greater than 2 inches, 5 inches, then that's 5 centimeters or 2 inches, they could see that. If there's meningitis, meaning inflammation in the meninges, they could do a spinal tap and see that the white blood cell count is high and the protein is elevated, or that the antibodies are there. So they wanted to be able to have very objective markers to secure the definition. They clearly stated from the very beginning that clinicians should not be using this as the sole criteria for diagnosis. But nevertheless, clinicians started to use that as the sole criteria for diagnosis. And that was harmful to patients, because people started being told, oh, no, you don't have Lyme disease because you don't meet the epidemiologic case definition. That's not at all what the case definition was meant for. Right. So, but yes, the answer to your question was yes, the neuropsychiatric features were not in it, and they're not in it now. And it's unfortunate, because that means we're missing cases.
Yeah, it might be a good time to update the case study.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no, I saw that in one of your presentations. So thanks for giving that historical context. I think that's helpful. Can you tell us about the Clinical Trials Network?
Sure. This is really exciting news, and I hope people are just as excited as I am.
Yeah,
it's really fun for me. The Cohen Foundation, the Stephen and Alexander Cohen Foundation, provided us with a grant to establish a clinical trials network. And the idea behind the clinical trials network is that, number one, there are very few treatment studies of Lyme and other tick-borne diseases. Number two, a lot of people might like to do clinical trials, but they don't know how to do it, or they don't know how to do it well. And number three, we at Columbia have a lot of experience doing clinical trials. I've done a lot of them in the course of my life, in anxiety disorders, as well as in tick-borne diseases. And my colleagues at Columbia have as well. So we became a coordinating center for the conduct of clinical trials for people, investigators around the country who might be interested in conducting trials at their own institution. So, for example, our first colleagues on this in this adventure include John Alcott at Johns Hopkins and Roberta DiBiase, who's the chief of pediatric infectious disease at Children's National Hospital in D.C. So the three of us have been meeting with others in our respective communities every 2 weeks to discuss clinical trials and design of clinical trials and how we can get more people involved. And so at this point, Dr. Alcott at Hopkins is doing a tetracycline study, 3 months of tetracycline versus placebo. We are launching a vagus nerve stimulation study with the idea that the vagus nerve is this fascinating nerve. It's the longest cranial nerve. It's amazing. It's totally fascinating.
You're doing this research. It really is exciting.
It is. I remember, actually, I've been interested in the vagus nerve stimulation since 2012, because I saw that there was a company in Europe that had gotten approval for treating epilepsy with it. So I contacted them. They came to visit me, and they came to visit a group at Harvard to try to get their device tested in the U.S., but they ended up not doing it because of the intense malpractice coverage, which was going to be too much for them. So unfortunately, it got delayed. But now we're able to collaborate with, or not collaborate, we're able to get devices from a company in New York called Soterix that makes outstanding vagus nerve stimulation devices for research use. And the interesting part is that we can stimulate the external branch of the vagus nerve, which is right on the outer portion of the ear, and on the tragus as well. And if you stimulate that, it appears in some studies that leads to a reduction in pain, a reduction in fatigue. Sometimes it can lead to a reduction in systemic inflammatory markers. So there was one nice study showing those benefits among patients with lupus. And so as a result of that, there's going to be a large clinical trial looking at transauricular, meaning on the ear, on the surface of the skin, vagus nerve stimulation for lupus. We're going to be doing one for patients with persistent Lyme symptoms. Prior to the external vagus nerve stimulation, there was a surgically implanted vagus nerve stimulator device that actually was shown to be effective in improving patients with severe depression, as well as for patients with refractory epilepsy. So here is a device that has anti-inflammatory effects, and it has cognition-enhancing effects in some studies. It has pain-reducing effects in some studies. And so it's extremely interesting, and I hope it indeed does help our Lyme patients, because it would be a really nice thing.
Yeah, and it does seem like the cost is relatively inexpensive compared to some other things that people
know. Absolutely, absolutely.
Mm. Can't hurt, right?
Right. And then we're also, so as part of the clinical trials network work, we're also going to be starting a study looking at transcranial direct current stimulation, which sounds scary.
But I know. I'm really very curious to know more about that.
So it's really just two electrode patches are placed on the forehead. And for half an hour a day, you do two things. You connect those electrodes, which you put on your forehead, to this little device, which provides the stimulation. And while you're doing that, you use a neurocognitive enhancing brain program called Brain HQ. And the idea is that if you're doing the transcranial stimulation, as opposed to not doing the stimulation, the people who are doing the stimulation will have a greater improvement in cognition. So this is to help patients with brain fog.
Phenomenal. That's great. Now, we're based out of Canada, but we do have an international audience. So I'm wondering, are these studies that you're doing, are any of them open to patients outside of the United States?
That's a very good question. There's nothing in our proposal that, or our grant description, that says you can't participate if you're in another country. On the other hand, we want people to be able to come to Colombia and to mm-hmm. be able to come if they're not feeling well, or mm-hmm. so we would discourage people who are coming from too far away to consider the study, just because it's very expensive and we wouldn't be able to monitor them the way we would like to.
Right, definitely.
There's another study we're just also putting together, which is intravenous ketamine, which also is interesting. Ketamine is an anesthetic, which has been shown to be helpful, very helpful, in rapidly leading to a reduction in depression and in a reduction of suicidal thoughts. So it's actually been studied in the emergency room setting where people come into the ER, you know, with severe suicidal thoughts. If you give them ketamine, oftentimes those suicidal thoughts can diminish rapidly. So that's something that we're going to be assessing in our patients with Lyme disease, to see if it helps improve depression, but also improve some of the other symptoms as well.
Wow, I'm so excited about that. That's amazing. Now, as we wrap up, do you have any other closing comments?
Hope. Hope is essential. You have to hold on to hope. And I have seen so many reasons to hope, especially over the last 10 years. The academic community really is working much better together than they used to. And they're collaborating. And the example is this Clinical Trials Network. We're going to be joining, or the UCSF in San Francisco is going to be joining us as a node. And others will be joining us as well. And that all is going to lead to research advances in treatment. And so I think everybody in Canada and around the world should be excited by what I think research will bring.
That's great. And I do actually, I'm just looking at my notes. I have one last thing to ask you about. You had mentioned, I saw you present at the Live Lyme Summit. And I just was wondering, you had mentioned about the research that Dr. Sarah Mulkey is going to be doing. Are you able to comment on that?
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah. So Dr. Mulkey is a pediatric neurologist, and she's very interested in the question of what happens to children if the mother was acquired Lyme disease during pregnancy. So she's inviting women and to contact her who are pregnant and who get Lyme disease during their pregnancy. Obviously, we want those patients to see their obstetrician and get treated properly for the Lyme disease. But she's doing ultrasound, brain studies, MRI studies, and she's following up children after birth as well. So it's really to see if there's an effect. And I think she might also be expanding that study to include patients who had, let's say, acquired Lyme disease before. But certainly during pregnancy is her goal. So please check our website at LymeCTN.org to learn more about that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. We'll be sure to include all those links. And I really just want to say thank you so much. And I really love your message that hope is essential. And I believe that too. And that's why we do this podcast.
Yeah. Thank you for what you're doing. This has been great fun.
I encourage you all to dive deeper into Dr. Fallon's research. And remember, hope is essential. Stay safe in the outdoors.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As an industry grows, companies owned by white men tend to profit most.
Folks with more resources, longer histories of wealth, and larger networks are able to tap into industries more quickly and take up lots of market share.
Erica Simmons is Vice President of Equity and Workforce Development at the Solar Energy Industries Association, or SEIA. Her group wants to make sure that as the demand for solar grows, history does not repeat itself.
Who owns the businesses? Who gets to take advantage of the wealth-building opportunities of this industry is super important.
So to promote diversity in the industry, SEIA created a free online database of companies working in solar that are owned by women, veterans, and minorities, including Black and brown people and members of LGBTQ+ communities. The database makes it easier to find and hire these companies. And Simmons Group provides businesses in the database with information about networking and other opportunities.
We have an unprecedented opportunity to welcome more diverse voices into the industry.
So the transition to clean energy can also be part of a transition to a more equitable economy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not. The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Research shows that walking through a forest for just 15 minutes can lower symptoms of anxiety and depression and boost positive moods. What better way to welcome spring than by spending time among the trees? As a national nonprofit organization, Tree Canada works to improve the lives of Canadians by planting and nurturing trees in communities across the country. They support individuals, local groups, businesses, and municipalities to increase tree cover and help fight climate change. Join Tree Canada in growing better places to live by visiting treecanada.ca.
The SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance, referred to as DNA, is a student-led network of community members who identify as disabled, autistic, neurodivergent, deaf, mad, and or as having a disability, a chronic illness, long-term condition, or a mental illness. At DNA, we work together to create campus change. We address ableism, and we promote disability justice while opposing oppression in all of its forms. We are the SFU Disability and Neurodiversity Alliance. We are DNA. We provide support for students who are having difficulty with their schooling or accessing the services they need. Email access@sfss.ca or drop by the DNA Resource Center, room 1300 in the sub-building. That was access at sfss.ca, room 1300 in the sub-building.